Tuesday evening, the composer Fung Lam tweeting with the hashtag BBC Proms about James McMillan's Credo that we heard in the first half of the programme. Mesmerisingly beautiful, he says. And Henry Lamprecht, McMillan's Credo, a very impressive piece of music. Choral writing is brilliant, he says. Hashtag BBC Proms if you want to comment at any point to the music that you are hearing. Now, Bruckner, next from the BBC Philharmonic and Juanjo Mena. Bruckner was clearly a musical genius, yet throughout his composing career he was bedeviled by insecurities and plagued with doubts as to the quality of his work, which would often send him scurrying away to revise and rewrite. His Sixth Symphony was a rare example of a symphony that didn't undergo significant revision. Near the end of his life, he described it as being amongst his favourite works. The pace of the opening movement is fast for Bruckner. Perhaps he was trying to win over audiences in his adopted home city of Vienna by capturing something of Beethoven's dynamism and energy. One of the unique features of the Sixth, says Stephen Johnson in tonight's programme, is the interplay between major key light and minor key darkness. Bright pulsation on the surface, a dark and heavy theme coming from the cellos and basses below. Some of the darkest music in the whole work is heard in the second movement, complete with a brief funeral march and marked very solemn. Third movement scherzo features pounding bass notes. No respite comes in the trio, which is enigmatic, rather spooky pizzicatos alternating with confident folksy horns and woodwind. Then the finale, with movement, but not too fast, the marking. The enigma continues. There are sections where the music seems to take a moment to pause and meditate. The ending, when it comes, well, it's bright and muscular, but is it triumphant? Perhaps. Or perhaps not. BBC Philharmonic are tuned on the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall. And here comes Chief Conductor Juanjo Mena to lead this Proms performance of Bruckner's Sixth Symphony. We'll be right back. Bruckner's Sixth Symphony, Juanjo Mena conducting the BBC Philharmonic. Principal flautist Richard Davis, oboist Jennifer Galloway, and the rest of the woodwind section of the BBC Phil on their feet. Principal horn, Jonathan Goodall, Philip Stoker, Mark Brook, Andrew Budden, and Rebecca Hill, the horn section being brought up one by one. Principal trumpeter Jamie Proffitt. And the trombones and trumpeters stand. Bruckner 6 finished in 1881, didn't attain a complete performance during Bruckner's lifetime. The middle two movements were performed in 1883 in Vienna. The works remained the least accepted of his mature symphonies. Mahler conducted a trim version after Bruckner's death. An uncut version was not performed until 1901. The ravishing string writing of the piece and pounding bass notes of the scherzo, clearly a great influence on Mahler. There's a solo bow there for Paul Turner, timpanist of the BBC Philharmonic, who must be mentioned. Well, the BBC Philharmonic have one more Proms appearance this year. On Thursday, John Storgård, new chief guest conductor, will be in charge on the platform. And then they're off on tour to Lapland in the north of Finland, setting off there on Friday morning. Juanjo Mena embracing Max Zeugner, principal double bassist, who leaves the orchestra soon to take up a new job as a bassist at the New York Philharmonic. Well, after that performance of Bruckner 6, time to bid you farewell for now from the Royal Albert Hall. A section by section, finishing with the violins, shake of the hand of guest leader Lucy Gould, Juanjo Mena brings the whole BBC Philharmonic to its feet. Good night for now. Back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrock, thank you very much. Petrock Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall, and as well as the iPlayer online for the next 7 days, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom broadcast here on Radio 3 on Sunday, the 19th of August, during the afternoon. As for tomorrow night's Prom, Semyon Bychkov conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Always a productive relationship, that their Verdi Requiem at last year's Proms, for example. Tomorrow night, they tackle the UK premiere of the Battlefield Concerto by the Swiss composer Richard Dubignon, and a Richard Strauss battle scene as well, or at least a symphonic poem that includes one, his Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life. The concert opens with Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, and that's at 7:30 tomorrow night. As for the rest of this evening here on Radio 3, at 10:30 tonight, Proms Plus Late, a selection of post-prom music and poetry from young artists, and surrounding it, Dark Arcadias. More about those at 10:15, in 5 minutes' time, in fact. Until then, Bach via Villa-Lobos, a Villa-Lobos arrangement for 8 cellos of one of the preludes from Bach's 48 Preludes and Fugues. The players are the Pleath Cello Octet. the prelude number 8 in E-flat minor from book 1 of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, arranged by Villa-Lobos for an orchestra of cellos and played there by the Pleath Cello Octet. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 9:45. And now in the first of two feature programmes this week, Adam Nicholson investigates the idea of Arcadia and how it's been central to the Western imagination, and how, with Arcadia and its promise of the good life in harmony with nature, has come its opposite, darkness, separation and death. We begin in a cave in Nottinghamshire. Dark Arcadias.
I'm about 80 feet down into a small limestone tunnel in Nottinghamshire. It's totally dark in here. I can just see the green light at the mouth of the cave, like a little keyhole over there. But if I look down the other way, into the depth of the cave, the only sense is touch. And all there is the clammy, slightly gritty, bulbous sort of limbs and muscles of the rock. And it does feel incredibly animate in here. It's as if you felt with your finger and thumb, you might actually find the haunch of a bison or some muscle of some rock animal coming out at you. And, you know, if you wanted to think of somewhere where there was no gap between you and the material world or you and the natural world, where the rational mind is suspended, then this would be it. Outside in Cresswell Crags is a lovely June day with roses and comfrey and jackdaws and blackbirds and a whole layer of 19th century sublime, a lovely craggy park with a lake made by the Dukes of Portland. But come in here and every single element of Western civilization is suspended. You're back to the roots here. And that's the point, I think, that this cave, which is called Church Hole, because 19th century investigators thought its roof looked like some kind of Gothic vault, is the only cave here in this little gorgy valley which did not have or had hardly any evidence of people living here. They lived on the other side of the valley, which is south-facing, so the sun would warm it. But here, in this cave, the oldest signs in the British Isles of people thinking have been discovered very, very recently, in the last few years. The only Paleolithic rock art in the British Isles. And they're just up there, slightly nearer the entrance than where I am now. It's not surprising that people didn't recognise these carvings were here until just a matter of years ago, because they are so slight that this one here in front of me, which is on a sort of pendant slab of rock, is of some creature, something like a goat or a deer or an ibex, with its horn, two pair of horns, reaching up to the roof of the cave. And the whole thing only about, 2 feet long. But the really wonderful thing about it is that its eye, which is the place that one's own eye naturally is drawn to, its eye is an extraordinarily expressive little hollow in the rock, a tiny little pea-sized, slightly darker indentation, and expressive of, mysteriously expressive of, a kind of animal wariness, a sort of distance, an alertness, even amazingly a kind of brightness in it. And the whole of the rest of the animal form is drawn, maybe, because that is a natural hole in the rock. So if you imagine this slab with nothing carved on it, and the person being here 12,000 years ago, And he is in here. We're nearer the mouth of the cave, so there's quite a lot of light here. And he's looking at this slab of rock. And suddenly he sees in it the eye of another creature. And the eye of the kind of animal that he might have seen in the woods outside. And then from that eye, from that kind of spirit presence of the creature, he then draws the rest of its being out of the rock. It's as if the rock is not a solid thing, but a permeable membrane beyond which another kind of life exists, and through which, by his own art, to use that word, he draws its being into three-dimensional reality. And in a way, I think that sense of the natural and the vital and the spirit of life being implicit in rock and in natural forms is, in a way, the Arcadian condition. It's one of total connectedness, no distinction between me, my mind, his mind, its mind, the world mind, a complete identity of being. And that is the condition which later life, the life of the city in a shorthand, breaks. And the rupture which city, which urbanity, civilization creates, is the break that Arcadianism wants to mend. Arcadia wants to return to the condition of mind which made this carving. Looking at it like that may be rather naive and sentimental, I think, because you can be sure that if this was the cave for other things, the cave where normal life didn't go on, then there is inherent in that idea a kind of power structure. There's an exclusion there. This is not a place where everyone can come and mess around or light a fire. And so it may be that already here, looking at this, being with this now, you are in the presence of power, of control, of maybe a shaman, a priest, who had some special access to this understanding of the fluency, the liquidity of the world, of the no gap between people and nature. It may not have been an entirely shared thing. Other people had to get on and make supper. And so already here, many of the problems that become very apparent in the idea of Arcadia later are present, that here is power claiming a privileged access to the beautiful and the potent. And power usually, almost inevitably, involves violence, imposition, exclusion, hurt. So this is where the story begins, in that incredible integrated consciousness of Stone Age man. And from here I'm going to go on through the whole long story of the Arcadian idea over the last many thousands of years. And the first programme is really about the origins of those ideas, mainly in classical Rome, but how they fold on into medieval life. And the second programme looks at what happens to those ideas in the modern world, when we begin to suspect them in many ways, when the romantic view of the broken and the modern view of atomized life impacts on those smooth continuities of the Arcadian vision. So partly it is a story of one thread of Western civilization, but it's also, I hope, an exploration of why I think and feel in the way I do about the natural world. It's really about the genealogy of thoughts that we like to think of as our own. Why do we like to feel free in nature, or think that we can feel free in nature? Why do we have such a deep loathing of pollution? Why really do we feel hostile to the cities on which we all actually rely? Why do we believe that country life is somehow purer and feel so sceptical about that idea? It's really about our pretense and desire that in certain places we can somehow drop culture and become natural beings close to the world we want to love. I'm now in Italy, just a couple of miles south of Mantua, in the Po Valley. And this is where Virgil, this exact place, is where Virgil was born about 70 BC. And it's a riverine world, the lush, full of, nowadays, full of poplar plantations, thick reed beds, a kind of general dampness, wonderful birds. And it's a very, very different world from the dark of the cave. By the time Virgil's born, the universe has changed. There are cities, places are organized, there are big state power structures. The whole relationship to nature shifts because man's intervention in it is now huge. He builds roads, imposes himself, changes it. And those are the circumstances in which Virgil writes his poems. He was the son of a farmer, a poor man. He was born, marvellously, in a ditch. His mother couldn't get to a farmhouse in time and dropped him among the reeds and the rushes, this great, great man coming out of a green, lush, ditchy bed. I just love that. Anyway, by the time he comes to write his poems, the first poems are called the Eclogues, they're shepherd poems. He's in Rome, a sophisticated man, educated, very familiar with all kinds of Greek models, especially the idylls of the Greek poet Theocritus, who had written about shepherds as charming, beautiful, elegant poets as shepherds, singing songs to each other in the rough, wild lands of Arcadia in the Peloponnese. Virgil undoubtedly knew those poems. And the Eclogues